Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 308. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about cathedrals and vineyards and drinking stars as we go to the Champagne region of France. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have three news stories for you. All three news stories this week are flying related. A Ukrainian man faces serious consequences after being charged with groping a Singapore Airlines flight attendant. Now remember, this is Singapore, and he was apparently on his way to Singapore. And so he either faces 2 years in jail, a fine, or caning, or a combination of these. Now, I'm not a big fan of corporal punishment, but I'm not a big fan of groping flight attendants either, so hard to know which way to root with this one. And then another story that leaves me a little bit conflicted. The flyer who thwarted the underwear bomber is now suing the airline with a $10 million lawsuit for injuries because they say that the airline, Delta Airline and Air France KLM, should have kept the underwear bomber off the plane. Now, the only problem is the airlines are not in charge of that, so it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. And then in other dramatic news, a Qantas flight had a computer error. Your computer has errors all the time, but this one caused the flight control computers to put the jet into a 193-meter nosedive. At least 51 passengers and crew were hurt, some suffering broken bones and spinal injuries because of a computer error. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Don George, travel writer, travel editor for Gadling, as well as for National Geographic, editor-at-large for National Geographic. And I say welcome back to the show because Don and I are re-recording an episode on Champagne region of France that we tried to record a couple weeks ago. Don, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. I'm sure we'll get it right this time.
And I appreciate your patience. Just so people know, we had a hardware problem with a microphone that just produced an episode that wasn't worth listening to, except for the content was terrific, so I thought we would try it again, and Don was gracious enough to allow it. So, Don, you have been writing about travel for a couple years.
A few now, yes.
Yeah. Had never been until recently to the Champagne region of France, or Champagne.
That's right. I had actually lived in France just out of university, and had been back many times to other regions of France, but I had never been to Champagne until this most recent September, October.
And when we say Champagne, what is the geographic region we're talking about?
It is in the northeast part of France. If you have a sense of where Paris is, the Champagne region really curls kind of around Paris to the north and to the east. And most of the highlights in the Champagne region are about an hour and a half from Paris, so it's eminently visitable for anybody who's going to France. It's really easy to get there.
And that's one of the things I thought was interesting when we talked about doing an episode on this region. It's an easy add-on, this or the Loire or the Normandy, or an easy add-on to a trip to Paris.
Absolutely. And in the same way that you wouldn't want to just visit New York or San Francisco or L.A. if you were visiting the United States, visiting Paris is fantastic, wonderful. You have to do that. But getting outside Paris opened up a whole new side of France. The people are different. The scenery is different. The landscapes are beautiful. the pace of life is different, so it really enriches your sense of what France is all about. And Champagne happens to be a beautiful region in terms of the landscape, but also the bubbly beverage that it specializes in is also a huge attraction for me.
And so we talk about the bubbly beverage and the region. What is it that attracted you to the region?
Well, really two things. One is I had heard that it had just beautiful countryside, and I was stunned and astonished at how unpopulated it was. I guess, you know, living in California, maybe I just get used to seeing a lot of houses, especially in the Bay Area. But when we got into the countryside of Champagne, miles and miles of just rolling green hillsides and no houses. So it was really beautiful. It was spectacularly beautiful countryside. And then I do love Champagne. I've loved Champagne for a long time. I've been cultivating a passion for it. And it's fun to go to the place that's kind of the center. It's the capital. It's the Mecca of Champagne. And to study it there and meet people who share your passion and drink it. So those were two huge allures for me, and they were both amply satisfied.
And what were the highlights for you of the trip?
Well, one of the things I have to say is just getting back in touch with the Western cultural history. I hadn't been to Europe in about a year or so, and I hadn't been to France for a few years. And just reconnecting with the cathedrals and the extraordinary museums, all of that was a real highlight. And Champagne has a lot of amazing architecture and amazing history. Reims was a huge highlight for me, the cathedral at Reims, where they've been crowning the kings of France for centuries and centuries and centuries, going back, I think, to the 7th century. That's an amazing cathedral with so much history and beautiful stained glass artwork and great museums. One of the surprises for me was a town called Troyes, T-R-O-Y-E-S, that I had never heard of in 25 years as a travel writer and editor. Never heard of it. And it's a beautiful, charming village with 16th century half-timbered houses, great museums, very interesting shops that produce everything from local biscuits to great wine, champagne. That's a really fascinating small town that I just didn't know existed, and it sort of humbles you. You realize, I don't know so much more than I know, and it's delightful to discover a place like that. And I know that if I ever go back to France, and of course I'm intending to go back almost as soon as I can, I want to go back to Troyes because there was so much to explore there, the cobblestone streets and beautiful architecture and great cuisine. It was really a surprise for me.
Now, we should say, as I recall, you were a guest of the France Tourism Board on this particular trip.
Yes, I was a guest of the France Tourism Board and the regional tourism boards of Burgundy and Champagne and Air France.
Okay.
But that did not in any way influence my enjoyment of the champagne that I drank.
That's good to know. Good. Well, and let's get to the champagne. So you went to at least one champagnery.
We did. One of the highlights of the trip was a visit to a family-run champagnery, which felt very much like a Napa Valley boutique winery. It's called Drapier, D-R-A-P-P-I-E-R, Champagne Drapier, in a little town called Urville, U-R-V-I-L-L-E. And the proprietors were the most charming people imaginable, very warm and gracious. They gave us a full tour of the champagnery, and then we were ensconced in a beautiful sitting room and just were allowed to taste about 6 or 7 different champagnes. And you really could note the differences and distinctiveness of each one. And there was a rosé, and there was a very dry one. And it was fascinating to me as somebody who's sort of an amateur. Like the amateur traveler, I'm the amateur drinker, and I really...
You do it for the love of it. I appreciate that.
I really have enjoyed champagne for decades, literally, but I don't know that much about it. So it was a wonderful education to wander around and see how it's produced, and then to be able to taste it with a master who could talk about the qualities. And also just gave off this Buddha-like enjoyment of life. It was really, really wonderful. It's one of the highlights of the trip.
And I believe he told you his secret to life.
He did indeed. This was the 80-something-year-old grand master, the patriarch of the place, who was this wonderful, beaming, gentle man. And I asked him at one point, you know, what the secret to his success and happiness and health was. And he said, I drink a bottle. And I thought he probably meant a bottle a week or whatever. And so I asked a bottle how often. He said, I drink a bottle a day. I drink a bottle of my own champagne a day, and that's why I'm as good as I am right now. So that became my new regime as well. Well, or the regime I aspire to, I should say. Someday I'm going to drink a bottle of Drapier champagne a day, and I hope I look as good as he does when I'm in my 80s.
Now, you talked about how different the production... You've been to a winery before, so you'd seen a wine tour, I'm assuming.
Right, yes.
But champagne is different in terms of how it's produced. Anything stand out for you for that difference?
Well, the riddling, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, how a lot of it's done by hand now.
And I'm going to have you describe what riddling is, because that's something that might be just a riddle to somebody, I'm afraid.
That's right. It might sound like Batman or something. You're in a room where there's a rack of champagne bottles, full of champagne, and there's a gentleman who gives each bottle a slight turn with the wrist, and it's just to make sure that the sedimentation process goes smoothly and evenly and that there's a well-balanced champagne that's produced. And like I was saying, a lot of this is done by machine now, but it was nice that at Drapier there is a special room where it's still done by hand. And it was just interesting to know that that's a part of the process and that there is this sort of human connection with the bottle that mm-hmm. gets transferred from the maker to whoever is lucky enough to buy one of those bottles.
Well, I believe the original story is that Dom Pérignon, the Benedictine monk who invented champagne accidentally, basically snuck a sip of this white wine that wasn't a sparkling wine originally and went back to the same bottle and must have put it back in a different way and exclaimed that he was drinking stars, but basically figured out eventually that this process of turning the bottles to work the sediment down into the neck of the bottle, and now they freeze the neck of the bottle in the dressage process.
Right, right. And I love that description of drinking stars because it does feel that way. And of course, it kind of looks that way too, with a delicious golden bubbly wine and a champagne. It just looks like little shooting stars. And there's just something so festive about champagne. Every time I drink it, I feel good. I feel like I'm celebrating something.
Well, and as I mentioned to you last time we tried this show, the one champagnerie that I visited in the region was Mouet et Chandon in Epernay, mm-hmm. and that is the home of a relatively well-known champagne called Dom Pérignon. Mm-hmm. And they have a habit there of when someone famous shows up, I don't know if they tried this with you, but when someone famous like the Queen shows up, they open up a bottle from the Queen's birth year. And we asked, well, does that work? Because champagne is not meant to be kept that long. And they said, well, sometimes you have to open quite a few bottles.
That's great. They did not open up a bottle for my birth year. But next time I go back there, I'm going to demand that something like that be done. What they did do, which was really delightful, was they were about to introduce a rosé. It wasn't yet on the market. I guess it is now because this was in early October and they were going to introduce it in about a month. But they gave us an advanced preview taste of it. And I'd always been kind of a snob about rosé champagne. I just didn't think it was the real deal. But it was delicious and it was beautiful. And on a fall day with the sun kind of slanting through these beautiful French windows and a mansion surrounding you, the rosé champagne was really both in looks and in taste, just stunning, incredible. So if I find Drapier Rosé Champagne in the U.S., I'm going to buy it, no matter what. It was really, really delicious. It was amazing.
And getting away from the drink to the region, you'd mentioned Rheims and going to the cathedral there. Anything else stand out for you from that very historically significant town, obviously?
Oh, there's so much there. The museum that's right next to the cathedral is an absolute must to visit. There's so many historical artifacts there, incredible gold artifacts that were really mind-boggling, everything from goblets to pendants that people would have carried and ermine robes that the kings would have worn and all kinds of very interesting artifacts like that. And
now, that's the museum that has the crown jewels of France?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And so totems like that kind of bring history to life in a way that reading about it on a dusty textbook page doesn't. You see the replica of the actual crown of the King of France and you think, oh, I get it. Or you see the real diadem that a king would have carried and you go, oh. This personalizes it and materializes it in a way that's really wonderful. And then just taking in the sound and light show that they had at the cathedral at Reims, which is, again, sometimes sound and light shows can be kind of kitschy, but this one was just extraordinary. It was educational, but it was also mind-bogglingly delightful, and the way that they would spotlight certain architectural features of the cathedral or sculptures, the face of a woman, the face of a man, it really just gave a whole different light and light to the cathedral itself. So the sound and light show, definitely I would say anybody going to Reims should try to get there when that's going on, because it's very much worth staying around for.
Okay. And Reims, as I recall, Joan of Arc also had a connection to Reims.
Yes, Joan of Arc had a big connection to them. I'm trying to remember, she crowned the king Clovis, I believe it was.
Clovis, I think, is earlier. Clovis is pre-Charlemagne.
Oh, Clovis is like 5th or 6th century.
Yeah.
5th century. Clovis is 5th century, and the bishop baptized Clovis on the site where the Cathedral of Reims stands today.
Right.
And that was the conversion. He was the king of the Franks. That led to the birth of France, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes way back to the 5th century. That's right. And then Joan of Arc also was very prominent in Reims, and I can't remember exactly.
I want to say that that's where she was burned alive, but I could be mistaken.
No, I think you are right, but I don't have that in the forefront of my brain right now, unfortunately. But I'll look it up. But probably not right now. I won't look it up right now. But yeah, I believe that's where she was burned as well.
I know she expelled the English from there, so I could be wrong about that. But okay. And then other things that stand out from the trip.
One thing that really stood out, we actually went to the Charles de Gaulle monument, which was also very fascinating. This is contemporary history. But it was really put in context kind of what de Gaulle's meaning to the French nation was, his role as a historical player. It was very interesting. And again, in the same way almost as the museum in Reims, it humanized history in a way. And I had never realized, even though I know that Charles de Gaulle was an extraordinary figure, I didn't realize just how important he was to France and to the nation's sense of itself. And so that was really fascinating. And we had an amazing lunch at just a little country inn near there. And that's in the village called Colombie des Deux Églises, which is Colombey hyphen Les hyphen Deux hyphen Eglises. So
the village of two churches.
The village of the two churches, right. Only one of the churches remains. But
and they didn't rename the village, I noticed then.
No, I know. Interesting. So that was pretty fascinating, too. And the day that we were there, a number of old decorated war veterans came to pay their respects, and it was incredibly moving to see these 88, 90-year-old gentlemen in full uniform with their breasts dangling with all kinds of medals, paying their respects at the monument to Charles de Gaulle. That was a very sober and moving, very poignant moment for me to see that. So that was also a real highlight.
Excellent. And before we go on, I should apologize to the two or three people who've been yelling at their iPod or their computer that Joan of Arc was not burned at the stake at Reims, but instead at Rouen.
Oh yeah, Rouen. That's right.
After she was successful in getting Charles the VII coronated at Reims. And then to the rest of you who really just don't care, I'll apologize to you as well.
That's what it was. Charles the VII was coronated. That's right. Right, right, right. Okay. But Rouen, that's right. That's where she was burned.
Did you meet any of the locals who stand out for you? You mentioned your friend with a bottle of champagne a day.
He certainly stood out for me. But I was just wandering in Troy, and I went into a little art gallery and struck up a conversation with the owner, who was probably mid-50s, early 60s, sort of a professorial kind of guy, who was incredibly learned about art. I would ask him about a painting, and he would give me a 15-minute discourse on the painter and the subject. And it just was kind of wonderful that in a small town there was a person, and you got the feeling that he was just emblematic of a lot of people in the town, that he was proud of the heritage, proud of the culture, knew a lot about it, wasn't obnoxious in sharing it, but very enthusiastic in sharing what he knew and his love for art. And Then he pointed me down the cobbled street to a great little restaurant where he said he always liked to go, and I had a wonderful meal there. And the people were very friendly, very outgoing, and utterly delightful. And there were other delightful aspects, too. A bunch of the towns we went through had merry-go-rounds set up in the middle of town, and it just kind of gave a whimsical sense to a lot of the places. You got the feeling that people enjoyed life and celebrated life and took things seriously, but not too seriously, that they cherished the joys of everyday life. And that was a great lesson for me.
And I'm curious, here's an analogy for you. This the old SAT question. I often hear the analogy that Paris is to France as New York is to the United States.
Right.
In personality and brusqueness sometimes, things like. And Champagne is more like what?
Well, something California, I would say. A more cosmopolitan Napa.
Okay. So not jeans and T-shirts.
Right. And perhaps if Healdsburg were a 16th century place with half-timbered houses, that would be it. But it has the feeling, it has the cultural feeling of Napa. There's vineyards everywhere. You go into a town and every other store specializes in selling wines and champagnes, and people are into it. You can get into a very sophisticated champagne conversation with almost anybody, it seems like. So they love and enjoy the product of their region. There's also great cheeses and sausages. And so in that sense, it's a bountiful, bountiful place, which reminds me a lot of Napa also. So I guess I would say Napa.
Okay. And then getting around, I'm assuming you're renting a car.
I was on a press tour, so we were being taken around by car. But yes, if I were traveling on my own, I would do that. And as I said earlier, it's about an hour and a half from Paris, or even you can go directly from Charles de Gaulle Airport. You can just zoom into Paris and get on a train and be in Reims in about an hour and a half. So it really is very, very easy to get there. And then you could rent a car and stumble into beautiful inns. And one place I do want to mention, we stayed at an amazing hotel in Troyes called La Maison du Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S, like the Greek island. And it was an old 16th century half-timbered mansion that had been converted into a hotel. And you felt a little bit like you were staying in the 16th century meets the 21st century. There were modern amenities, but the facade and the feeling, the atmosphere, the stones that you were stepping on and the wood beams in the dining room where you were eating, they were all so wonderfully authentic and sort of spoke of age and antiquity. It was really a great experience to stay there. That's, if I go back, when I go back, that's one place I'm going to definitely stay. I love that hotel.
Now, you alluded to it earlier, but you lived in Paris for a while. You lived in France for a while.
Right.
What still surprised you about Champagne?
One was the lack of houses. Mm-hmm. I was very much surprised by that. You're driving through terraced, gently rolling, very green countryside, speckled with cows, and very few people. And then another thing that I'd just forgotten was that when you did run into a village, it was 100-year-old stone houses, incredibly beautiful, postcard-perfect stone houses that I'm sure have their nightmares inside in terms of plumbing and being warm in winter and cool in summer and that sort of thing. I'm sure that there are challenges involved with that, but visually they were just stunning. And it made me want to do a Peter Mayle and buy a little abandoned farmhouse and settle right there, because you just felt like you're in a picture of tranquility, of these beautiful old stone buildings, and then there'd be a little cafe on the main square, and you'd go down and have a perfect cafe creme and baguette, and life was pretty much perfect. And I could imagine, probably falsely, but I could imagine living a very delighted life there for a long time and waking up in the morning and wandering among the fields. So I was surprised by how few homes there were, and then the homes that were there, how old they were and how beautiful they were. There were no trashy homes at all. There were no equivalents of dilapidated places that you might find in other parts of the world. Everything seemed to be very well taken care of. And then just the warmth of the people was surprising to me, and the sort of rural sophistication of the people. They weren't city snobs, but they were clearly people who had a sense of life and history and culture and relished that, and that was really nice.
Excellent. If you had one picture that is quintessential for Champagne, what's the view you're looking at? Where are you standing?
was one place where, and this segues from what I was just saying, because there was an abandoned farmhouse that had a for sale sign out in front of it. And a little winding country lane that went up by it. And I remember standing at the for sale sign, looking through the window of this beautiful rock-hewn house. And then beyond the house was a gently sloping terraced hillside of vineyards. And then in the distance, there was another rising hillside that was forested. So you had sort of lemon green sloping fields in front of you and then darker green fields beyond. And beautiful puffy white clouds, blue, blue sky, and this stone house. And I just remember thinking, wow, what would it be like to wake up here every morning and just look out on these vineyards? And it kind of captured the quintessence of the region for me. And then you'd have to have a little flute of champagne in there somewhere to really get the full flavor. But that, to me, was the allure of it, was that very beautiful sense of history and natural beauty both together.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Champagne?
I think the fact that pretty much as soon as you sat down somewhere, a bottle was popped and champagne was poured. You never, ever had to say anything like, could we have some champagne? Before your rump hit the chair, the champagne was already flowing. And that just seemed to be like, you might say good day to someone. The champagne was already there, maybe like tea being served in some parts of the world. Champagne was flowing pretty much everywhere we went, where we sat down to have a conversation with people. So I thought that was very distinctive. I can't think of any other place I've been where champagne was just immediately assumed that that's what you were going to drink, and here it was.
I suspect that might not be unconnected to being on a press trip, though.
I'm going to go back on my own, and I'll report back to you about that.
It'd be good to know.
We'll see how it goes. Yeah, I'll be saying, where's the champagne? Wait a minute. I'm already sitting down and there's no champagne.
Before we wrap up, I've got three last questions for you. Anything else you think that people really should know before they go to this beautiful region of France?
I think it's important, and it's not specific to this region of France, but just that the more you try, the more people appreciate it. And I think that Americans especially bring a lot of baggage to France, certainly to Paris, but to all parts of France about I can't speak the language and they're going to be snotty. And what I found was that some of the people in the group I was with didn't speak much French at all, but the French that they tried to speak, it was so warmly received and people were so appreciative that was really great. And just picking up little tiny tips, like when you walk into a shop, you say, good day, ladies and gentlemen, bonjour, monsieur, dame. That immediately changes everyone's attitude towards you. Even if that's all you know to say, they feel like, oh, you've taken the trouble to learn our customs. Isn't that wonderful? You're a good American, and they'll be very kind to you. So I think that just opening yourself up, not being afraid to take some chances, everybody I met in the region was really warm and kind and friendly, so I would definitely say that. And then just to give yourself time, because, for example, when we got to the Strapier Champagnerie, we were supposed to be there for about an hour, but we ended up spending about 3 hours there because it was just so delightful and amazing. And so if you're on a tight itinerary and you're looking at your watch and you're thinking, gosh, I've got to get out of here and move on to the next place, you may very well miss what's so wonderful about the place you're in. So travel with an itinerary, but a very loose itinerary that's flexible, because you're going to stumble upon a little shop in Troy where you're going to end up spending an hour talking to the man who's going to tell you about the painting, because it's so delightful for you and delightful for him. And for me, that's what travel's all about. So be flexible, leave a lot of room in your itinerary.
Excellent. One story I'm going to ask you to tell. You have a little bit of a special connection to France, and the fact that you are, and I was kidding you that you've been a travel writer for a year or two. It's been a little longer than that. But it was France that made you a travel writer.
That is right. I went to France originally out of university. My very first time living in France, I lived in Paris the summer between my junior and senior years in college on a summer work abroad program. And then I went back the next summer because I loved it so much. And I actually had gotten a fellowship to live in Greece for a year. And I thought, well, before I go to Greece, I'll spend another summer in Paris And I was lucky enough to get the same work abroad situation, and I went back again. And I remember very, very distinctly there was a moment when my life changed. I mean, I thought I would do a year abroad, and then I'd go back to university and study comparative literature and become a Tweedy professor and spend my life in dusty, musty, ivy-clad halls talking about fusty, musty literature. And instead, there was a moment on the Rue de Rivoli, actually, which is where my apartment that second summer was, when I got down into the street, and there was a stream of people passing by, and on the right there was a tabac with some periodicals for sale and some magazines and newspapers, and they were all in French, and the perfume was French, and the people were speaking French, and I was paying for my Café Crème with francs, and just I was immersed, surrounded by this sea of Frenchness. And I remember very distinctly having a moment where I thought, why would I go back to the United States to a university if my point in studying literature is to try to understand the culture of a place? Why not just stay here in the classroom of Paris? The lessons are much better here. The curriculum is a whole lot more lively here than it is back there. And I just thought, I think I'll become a student of the world. I think the classroom is right here. And that really, really changed my life. And I didn't at that moment understand that being a travel writer was really an option, but it made me realize that I wanted somehow to make studying in the world what I did for a living. And then the travel writing part just kind of fell into place as time went by. And here I am a quarter of a century later, still having done it all my life and pinching myself almost every day. It's pretty extraordinary. I feel incredibly lucky and actually blessed in some way that it all worked out, but I owe it all to Paris, because Paris really made me realize this is where I want to be. This classroom is where I want to be.
Excellent. But two more questions for you. Mm-hmm. To finish this sentence, you really know you're in Champagne when what?
When they bring out the fifth bottle of champagne, and it's even better than the four before.
You don't think that's somewhat related to having four before? And then if you had to
say, it has everything to do with having four before.
If you had to summarize Champagne in three words, what three words would you use?
Bubbles?
I was thinking of the region, but...
Oh, you were thinking of a region?
Yes.
If I had to define champagne with three words?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the region too. But okay. So bubbles and bonhomie, sort of friendship, okay. And mm-hmm. good feeling. And history, just the historical richness. So the friendliness of the people, the incredible history of the place, and then the great beverage that it's famous for.
Excellent. Now, Don, you've done a fair amount of travel writing. You have literally written the book on travel writing, the Lonely Planet travel writing book. Where can people read more about your travels?
I am in a number of places. I do write a column for National Geographic Traveler where people can follow what I'm reading and the book review column. So it's the vicarious travel that I'm doing. I write for Gadling a lot. Every month I write for Gadling, and that's where I write about my journeys most reliably. I edit an online magazine that's called Recce, R-E-C-C-E, and that's sponsored by Geographic Expeditions, which is an adventure travel company, and that's at geoex.com/Recce, and that I write about my adventures there. And then I also have a website called Don's Place. If you Google Don's Place, that takes you to it, and I write essays and narratives there, too. So I'm ubiquitous. You can find me in all kinds of places.
And you have a new book out.
And I do have a new book out, which is called Lights, Camera, Travel. And it's a Lonely Planet published anthology of stories by actors, screenwriters, and directors about their best travel experiences. And I co-edited it with Andrew McCarthy, the actor and travel writer. And it turned into a surprisingly delicious and exciting book for me. Alec Baldwin and Brooke Shields are among the contributors. There's a lot of really great writing in there that I wasn't expecting, and just a lot of great humanity that I also wasn't necessarily thinking these celebrities would feel comfortable putting on the page. So it's a really fun reading experience.
Excellent. I would have thought your previous book on the Movable Feast would have been more delicious, but...
It really was. Actually, A Moonful Feast is the most delicious book I've done, I think. I like that book a lot.
I was kidding Don that gave him a risk there of going from the editor-at-large of National Geographic to the editor-at-extra-large. Don, thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your obvious love for France and your newfound love for Champagne.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
In news of the community, I'd like to thank all those people who helped out with the Passports with Purpose project that was trying to raise money to build two libraries in Zambia. The goal was to raise $80,000. Instead, we raised $89,699 for the nonprofit Room to Read. So thanks again for your help. I was very surprised to get an email from Vance this week. Vance had written me last year about his trip to Kazakhstan, and almost an hour after the episode came out last week, he had already listened to it and wrote to say, "I would love to go back to Kazakhstan sometime and travel around by train and bus. I love getting to know the locals, and that sounds amazing. I still have lots of friends in Almaty that I would love to see again, too." Anyways, just wanted to say thanks again for your podcast, especially for all the work on the enhanced version. It's great to have the pics to go along with the interviews. And in case you are a new listener of The Amateur Traveler, that is a good reminder that there are two versions of The Amateur Traveler, one an MP3 version that'll play on many different players, and the other one an iTunes enhanced version that will play in iTunes and on Apple devices, and that one has pictures. Jeff wrote about the Dublin episode and said, "Let me say that your podcast is the best, and I hope you continue it for years to come. A few things were left out of the Dublin episode that I wanted you to know. Sometimes it takes a tourist, not a local, to pick up on some things. If you're interested in history, you must go to Kilmainham Gaol, which is where the Irish revolutionaries were held and executed. It was a fascinating way to spend an afternoon. Also, Phoenix Park is the largest urban park in the world, and I spent a day in September renting a bike and touring around there, watching a polo match, scoping out the deer, and having lunch next to a duck pond. Lance Armstrong was there not too long ago and rode with several thousand fans." And I think actually we mentioned the jail when we did an episode on Ireland before, but the park was new to me, so thanks so much, Jeff. And with that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. There are still presents to wrap here to get ready for Christmas. If you have any questions, please leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com or drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.